2018 Philcast Supplemental, number 3, Steve Yowell.
Whoa, we're halfway there. Whoa, living on a prayer.
Greetings, Earthlits, Borag Thong. Welcome to another 2018 Throwcast. I am Molchar, and that was just a little burst of my memories of pop music in the 80s. As you can tell, I erred on the wrong side. I apologise immensely. Why am I talking about this? Well, it's because this supplemental episode, we are talking to Steve Yowell, the artist on Zenith, which was his and Grant Morrison's, seminal, era-defining, amazing superhero series for 2000 AD from the 80s into the 90s. If you have never read Zenith, if you are a comic book reader, then you have to have it as part of your collection. It is one of those seminal books that needs to be on your shelf alongside books such as Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns. It is satire on pop music and pop culture. It's satire on superheroes. If you have ever read any Grant Morrison, then it's definitely something that you should know, just so that you can see the beginning of his career and also really the beginning of Steve Yowell's career, and it's going to be great to speak to Steve about Zenith and the influence on his career. If you want to read it, it is available on both sides of the Atlantic in hardcover editions, Phase 1, Phase 2, Phase 3 and Phase 4, which are all out now. You can also get it from the 2080 online shop at shop.2080online.com. You can also get a very special book, and this is the reason why we're talking to Steve this week. Zenith Phase 1, the Apex Edition, is our first ever kind of artist's edition of some 2080 artwork. And that is at the original size that it was drawn. The artwork, which Steve has kept all these years, has been painstakingly photographed, not scanned. So you can see printer's marks, editorial notes, fading speech bubbles, whiteout, tiny little changes in Steve's style on the page. It really is a beautiful artifact edition, and fascinating not just to lovers of comic books, but I think lovers of all good art. That is also available from all good comic book stores and through the 2000 AD online store. Now, as I've mentioned before, these supplemental episodes are intended to give you a little bit of more in-depth analysis and discussion about a particular artist. And Steve really is one of those definitive 2000 AD artists who's been with us for 30 years, still producing amazing work. And whether it's on Zenith, whether it's on Maniac 5, whether it's on Red Fang or Red Seas, Detonator X, Black Shuck, these are all strips that Steve has bought his very particular style too, and as we will discuss in the interview, when you look at Steve Yowell's artwork, it's unmistakable, and I think that makes him one of the greats at 2000 AD. So really, it's the only thing for me to do is to introduce Steve and say welcome to the Thrillcast, Steve.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for chatting to us for this special little episode. And just off the bat, congratulations on the Apex edition. It looks absolutely amazing.
Thanks very much. Yeah, everyone in production has done a bang up job. It looks fabulous.
Yeah, we'll come on and talk a bit more in depth about Zenith and the Apex edition and everything later on. I just really wanted to kick off and start at the very beginning, because I hear it's the very best place to start. And talk a little bit about you and your background. You're originally from Essex. Let's sort of chat about comics and how you came to be involved with them in the first place.
Right. Well, like most boy children in the 60s and 70s, I kind of grew up reading comics. Mm. And I established at a reasonably young age that that's what I wanted to do. But around the age of 15, 16, I kind of stopped reading them for, I guess, for the same reasons. It's all 15 or 16 year olds stop reading comics. And then when I was at college in Sheffield, I went to Sheffield, to Sheffield City Polytechnic, to do 3D design.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, strangely, I mean, I'm thinking at the point I did my Art Foundation course, because I slipped away from the comics world, and I got it into my head I was going to be a graphic designer or an illustrator or something along those lines. And we quickly established that probably wasn't really my route. And I ended up in the metalwork workshops, sort of making little, I don't know, pieces of jewellery and a little bit of light product design. And I ended up doing 3D design at Sheffield City Polytechnic. But it was while I was there, I started picking up comics again. First, Epic Illustrated.
Right.
Maybe even Heavy Metal, but I can't quite remember. And then I quickly found that I didn't really enjoy the, I don't know what you would call that, but those particular publications. They're not really the alternative press, are they? Anyway, I found I probably preferred the mainstream to the kind of material that you got in Epic and Heavy Metal. I'd been keeping an eye out still on what 2000 AD were doing, because my brother was four years younger than me, was still buying 2000 AD at the time. So although I didn't purchase them myself, I saw all those classic Dave Gibbons Rogue Troopers and Judge Death Lives, which is probably my all-time favourite Dread story, actually.
Right.
Okay. So by the time I was wrapping up my three-year degree, I'd kind of decided that I didn't really want to be a metal worker or a silversmith or a jeweller.
Right.
And I was interested enough in the comics again to think, well, you know, I'm going to give this a go. I'm really into this. I'm going to try and get back into the comics.
Right.
And I drew a strip for a small press publication called Totally Alien. I met the chaps that were publishing that through a mutual friend who I'd made whilst at college. And it was sending stuff around from Totally Alien and meeting David Lloyd and Mike Collins, Mark Farmer, through joining the Society of Strip Illustration, which has now become the Comics Creators Guild, I believe. If it still exists, I'm not entirely sure. That I got work on Martin Locke's Swiftsure title. If you remember, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, Mike.
Not quite old enough to remember.
You don't remember the Harrier titles?
No, I don't actually.
Don't remember the Harrier comics?
No, no, no. Explain a bit more about those for those like me who don't know them.
Yeah, I think Martin Locke had been writing and producing a strip, the title of which escapes me, but it was kind of loosely based on Star Trek. A friend of Brian Bolland's called Dave Harwood was drawing it and designing it. But anyway, Martin eventually started a line of small press comics, and he expanded on this universe he created within those pages. And there was a regular character called Lieutenant Fluff, spelled F-L apostrophe double F.
Right.
Who was a kind of female Vulcan kind of a figure. And anyway, Mike Collins and Mark Farmer were drawing a short story featuring her, which they couldn't complete, and I took over from them. Yes, and I'm trying to get my chronology right now. Now we've started talking about it, it feels like a lifetime ago. But from there, I believe I was working on. I got to work on a dummy comic David Lloyd was producing for Fleetway called Fantastic Adventure.
Yeah,
which was my first meeting with Grant. He was writing the strip I was down to draw called California Crew. David's big idea was that this Fantastic Adventure was going to, the stories within it were going to be based on the TV series that were popular at the time.
Yeah.
TV series and movies that were popular at the time. So there was a character called Johnny O'Hara that Grant was writing and John Burns was drawing, which was a kind of Indiana Jones figure.
Yeah.
And California Crew were loosely based on the A-Team. So anyway, that didn't go anywhere.
Right.
John Higgins, who was still colouring Watchmen. He was colouring Watchmen at the time.
Mm.
Saw some of my work, and he needed a hand helping out to finish a half page comic strip he was writing and drawing for a music magazine. I think, if I remember correctly, it was called The Street or The Street Scene, something like that. And for various reasons, he had slipped behind with the schedule. So myself and another friend of his helped out drawing and colouring it. I did the drawing, and his colleague coloured it. And yeah, what happened then? Yeah. Oh, that now. That's it. Then John was also on good terms with the chaps from Marvel UK, and I'd sent some Zoid samples into them. And the subject came up during one of their nights out, and John said, "Well, I've worked with Steve. Why don't we do something together? Do a cover together for you?" And they were up for that idea, but that fell through. But I got a cover anyway,
right?
For Spider-Man Zoids, and the cover featured Spider-Man in a black costume,
yeah,
and Star Brand, and Hela, who was the lead character in Zoids. From that, I got a fill-in on the strip. And then when Kev Hopgood moved on to Action Force, I got offered the strip full-time.
Right.
Grant was writing Zoids at the time. And at this, I think he was pitching Zenith to 2000 AD around then at the same time. And to sort of cut a long story short, I suppose the rest is history.
End of podcast. There we go. Well, let's. I mean, like you say, you've covered an awful lot there, but let's kind of go back. So, you'd gone from doing metal work and 3D design and things like that to hanging out with these guys as part of the what would become Comic Creators Guild.
Yeah.
Things were different back then, weren't they? Because you didn't have the massive proliferation of conventions. You didn't have the convention circuit as we have now. So the opportunity, the opportunities to meet guys like John Higgins and Mark Farmer and Mike Collins were not less, but were different. So, you know, rather than go to conventions and see them and talk to them while they're busy sketching at tables and whatnot and doing panels. Mm. You're going to meetings with these guys and hanging out with them as, you know, as somebody who wants to work in the industry. That's almost a kind of a trade union way of doing things.
Yeah, meetings, that kind of sounds very formal. It was the SSI, and the average meeting of the SSI was there'd be a talk by some kind of comics-related kind of a talk by someone producing something. Mm. A lot of it was just chatting in the bar, really, and showing, doing the kinds of things you do at conventions, really, just showing your latest work and talking about your latest work and just generally networking. I suppose that was the networking opportunity back then. I mean, and the other way to meet people was to go along to the regular comic marts they had at Westminster Hall
every
3 months. There was a pub around the corner from there called, I think it was called the Westminster Arms, where everyone used to hang out, and you'd go in there, and Alan Moore would be there, and Dave Gibbons would be there, and Mike and Mark would be there. And it was surprisingly easy to go and chat with them. You know, usually, you know, buying them a drink helped.
It always helps. That has never changed in comics.
But it was that was very much the networking avenue you had back then.
Mm-hmm. Your decision to pursue a career drawing comics. Was that sparked by anything in particular, or was it just a general feeling of coming to the end of your course and thinking, well, what do I want to do? I mean, had you been drawing much as part of your course?
The kind of formal drawing you'd do as part of that course.
Yeah. I mean,
there's a little bit of formal life drawing. And the kind of presentation pieces you'd have to draw when you're putting together a proposal for a project.
Mm.
But it was, funny enough, I sort of slipped away from that habit of drawing as well. And it was only when I started reading the comics again that I started drawing for my own pleasure.
Right.
Which I guess kind of must tell you something, mustn't it, really?
and what kind of things were you drawing at the time?
Oh God, I blush to think of it. just kind of general caricature-y kind of stuff that you'd do as a student, you know, based on people you were doing the course with. It doesn't bear repeating.
But I find it fascinating that you were more inspired by what we would consider the mainstream than you know. I've done lots of interviews over the years with artists and things like epic and heavy metal are referenced. Mm. You know, people say, "Oh, and you know, you discovered what comics could do with all this, you know, fully painted Frazetta stuff and all this, that, and the other." But it's interesting to hear that actually the idea, the ethos, the artwork of yeah, quote unquote mainstream comics. Appeal to you more than that?
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't quite know why that is. I mean, I can remember when I was younger, I was always drawn more to the kind of black and white titles than the fully painted titles. You know, I mean, there was fully painted artwork in Look and Learn. You know, Don Lawrence was painting Trigon Empire.
Yeah.
I think Bellamy was on Garth by then, so I can't remember if I ever saw any of his Thunderbirds work. But there was the very end of those Gerry Anderson Century 10-21 tie-ins.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
The very last days of TV21, Joe 90, Countdown with all that John Burns painted art, which was, you know, wasn't really. It's painted black and white artwork, John Burns, isn't it? Mm. It's rather than that fully rendered gouache painting that Don Lawrence does. But I was always drawn back for some reason to like DC Thompson titles and the Monthly War comics, in black and white, and American comics as well. But back in those days, I never picked up an American comic regularly because I could never. I don't think I could bring myself to wait a whole month for the next issue to come out. I used to like it every week. I used to like a fix every week.
Yeah.
But I used to get American titles through, remember these, secondhand comic stores.
Wow.
Market, where you could buy secondhand comics cheap, or you could trade your old comics in for more comics.
Halcyon days.
Halcyon days. Halcyon days.
And Once you kind of, so I mean, it's actually a way that when we attend conventions and we do panels about breaking into the industry, people say, you know, how do I do it? Do I do it through the submissions pile? Do I do it through this? And one of the ways is we always recommend getting to know people in the industry.
Yeah,
and it just sounds like that. It's a classic right place, right time, right person situation.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I suppose the only real lesson you can draw from these things is to just keep working.
Yeah.
And you know, they say you make your own luck, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You just gotta keep working and do that, you know, attend the conventions and talk to people and try and get your stuff out there. The prescribed route when I started was to work in the fanzines, and then to work in the fanzines could lead to some sort of low-paying small press stuff, and the low-paying small press stuff hopefully could lead to bigger-paying stuff at Marvel or Fleetway.
Yeah.
But I guess the similar route now is through online publishing and the small press. I mean, the small press now compared to what it was back then is as multiplied many times over.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you only have to go to Thought Bubble.
Well, I was about to say Thought Bubble fill an entire hall full of small press stuff, you know. So it's certainly the best way. I mean, at the time, what was the atmosphere like in comics? Because I mean, historically, you had Watchmen that was about to make this massive impact on our industry. You had the beginning of the phase of the end of British comics as we knew them. And Marvel UK were not that anybody particularly knew it, but were slowly winding towards their demise. What was it like? What was the atmosphere like for you as a young artist, as a young man in comics?
It was very exciting. I mean, the avenues just kind of seemed to have opened out at that time, and the kind of work that people were going to be able to produce seemed to be opening out. Because I saw Bill Sienkiewicz was, I think he was wrapping up New Mutants, and he was getting more and more experimental, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Producing Stray Toasters, the Elektra graphic novel he drew with Frank Miller. And things were getting more and more experimental. It was a very upbeat, exciting time.
And I find it interesting that your first kind of professional comics work was on a licensed comic, which many people would turn their nose up at these days. But I mean, I remember reading Spider-Man and Zoids with the odd little dose of Action Force or Hercules, whatever, thrown into the back. What was it like working on a weekly title for the first time?
Grueling, because obviously it's weekly deadlines. Yeah. You know, it's very much, you do feel like you're thrown in the deep end when you've got your first series of deadlines. So it was long days, but as you know, got the work in, bludgeoned my way through it. I mean, I never had any problem working on licensed titles. What you have to remember is that the most revered British comics of the 1960s was a licensed title, effectively.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
TV 21.
Yeah, absolutely. And nobody could possibly have known it at the time, but you work with Grant Morrison, who's gone on to huge things since. What was your first interaction like? Did you get to know one another, or was it a case of scripts turning up in the post and just getting them done?
Obviously the first script of his I ever saw was for Fantastic Adventure.
Yeah,
as I explained earlier, getting to know him, it was mostly through letter back then, because even when you phoned Glasgow, it's like phoning the moon. You forget just how bad the telephone system was back then. So most of our correspondence was through letter, but we seemed to strike it off sort of quite easily. Seemed to have an interest in similar things musically, I think. He was obviously far more interested in magic than I ever was. we just seem to strike a chord.
How did that relationship develop? Was it a friendship that ran alongside a professional relationship, or you know, how did you come to essentially be so have careers that were intertwined for quite a substantial period of time?
I guess it was just, like I say, we just sort of got on. He was always very happy to leave me to get on with the scripts. I don't think he ever asked for any changes from myself.
Right.
And you just developed a friendship through going to conventions and whatever, and the network of signings, which you end up doing through these projects.
Yeah.
Uh, Because what can I say? You do strike up this sort of quite a close relationship with writers, through a collaborative medium like comics.
Because there's a wonderful quote in David Bishop's Thrill Power Overload book where Grant describes realizing that you could be his Alan Davis.
that was very kind of him.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to see in hindsight that you were both part of that kind of new generation of creators that were coming through in 2000 AD in the kind of post prog 500 phase, which was essentially the new direction for 2000 AD. You know, the old guard were flitting off to America and to other projects. Did you get a sense of being the new guard?
I think so, yeah, because I mean, David had left 2000 AD by then. Kev had drawn Metalzoic. I can't remember. Oh, he'd drawn Metalzoic and he'd done little bits and pieces for Green Lantern, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they'd started Martial Law by that point. Brian had left 2000 AD a little while before that, hadn't he, to draw Camelot 3000 for DC. So, yeah, there was a very, a real sense of us being, having been given the keys to the family saloon.
And on the topic of Zoids, which is a comic that was close to my heart when I was a kid, what were the challenges, not just being a new artist, but working on something? I assume there was a style book, a way that you had to draw these toys, basically.
There wasn't a style book for the toys. There was a style book for the cast,
right?
As in the human cast.
Oh, really? Okay.
Which was, I think it was pretty much it was clippings from a lot of Kev's early work on the strip, which I guess had pretty much established the look of the characters.
Mm.
But as for the Zoids themselves, we were the office had a collection of the models and we used to post them around to each other. Get this big box of Japanese robots who come through the postman would bring to your door. We used to have them sitting on the shelves next to our drawing table, Zoidzilla and I can't remember the name of the big pterodactyl character. Was it Zark?
God knows.
Yeah. But it was great just having the toys come to your door.
And how long did you work on Zoids for?
Maybe 8 months, eight months to a year.
Okay.
The last thing I drew was there was a plan to produce it as a 22 or 24 page American style comic book, and then Marvel US would sell it.
Mm.
And I penciled the whole first issue and it was partially inked. And then I think it was the whole project was put on hold because Marvel wanted, there was a particular approach that Marvel wanted. And for whatever reason, the project was put on hold. But it was at that point actually that I started, I got the word about Zenith from Steve Mack at 2000 AD. So I moved on to Pastures New.
Okay. Well, never a better time to talk about Zenith, really. Which I mean, we describe as your breakthrough work, but it's more than that, really, isn't it? It's one of those strips that comes along every so often. I think every kind of phase of 2000 AD of any comic book has a story that not only defines it but sets the future in motion. It's kind of like a mission statement. This is the direction that we're going to go in, and certainly it felt, I mean, I came into reading Zenith much later, but even then it felt like a real kind of breath of fresh air. what was the first word you had on it? Was it something that Steve said, or had Grant discussed it at all, or how did you come to know about it?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about it until Steve Mack got in touch with me.
Okay.
Because he and Grant and Brendan had pretty much hammered out the synopsis for the first series. Brendan's character designs had been nailed, but he wasn't able to commit to drawing the series. And I think on the back of my having drawn firstly that Future Shock for Steve, so he was familiar with my work, and having worked with Grant on Zoids, so he was familiar with my work, Steve got in touch, and I think his words pretty much were, you know, we have a project you might be interested in, would you like to take a look? It was frankly a no-brainer once I'd got the, you know, once the background material came through the post. I mean, I knew I had to draw it. it was like every, you know, every exciting strip that was being published at that time rolled into one. You know, right. It was Watchmen, it was Crisis on Infinite Earths, it was, you know, everything.
Describe this background material that you got through the post.
I got Grant's plot synopsis for the first series, and then there was additional material that had gone backwards and forwards between him and Steve, discussing and altering a few aspects, and I got Brendan's character designs for Zenith, Peter St. John, Spook. Grant designed Ruby. Grant had done designs for Red Dragon, Voltage, Lux, basically, I was sent everything that's seen reprint in the back of the first volume of the recent Rebellion reprint.
Right. And what was your feeling about it? What was your impression as soon as you'd absorbed this material?
It was just really exciting. I mean, I hadn't seen anything like it before. And obviously, Brendan's designs are pretty unique.
Yeah.
And I kind of loved all that. Introducing those kind of 1960s music elements as well.
Because there's a quote from Grant again in Thrill Power Overload, where he talks about your work having pop realism, and the whole of Zenith is run through with all the not just pop culture references, but with sensibilities as well. How do you feel your artwork brought out that kind of shared idea that shared passion for things like pop and pop culture that you and Grant had?
Yeah, I think it's with my style referencing those classic 1960s comic styles, and you can see that kind of work. That kind of style repeated in most of the pop culture images of the 1960s. You know, from I can remember seeing bands projecting images of the Mighty Thor, probably against copyright. you know, in the early 80s. You know, you think of Roy Lichtenstein referencing all those comics panels that he did. And I think perhaps I was even a bit old fashioned by the early 80s, you know, late 80s, I beg your pardon, with drawing material like that. But and maybe it was the Alan Davis influence as well, because obviously there's a huge 1960s Gil Kane, Frank Bellamy influence in Alan's work. So it's the total of all those things. If that makes sense.
Well, it seems particularly on something like Zenith that you have, and this is going to sound maddeningly vague, a quintessentially British comics style in it has, you know, it evokes those creators of the 1960s that we've already touched on. But also it has a looseness, a vigour, You are not afraid to play around with perspective and viewpoint. You know, for all of the kind of forced perspective, a lot of old school American comics, the camera, as it were, always seems almost very fixed. You know, you have a set number of viewpoints, whereas particularly with Zenith, but also as your work has gone on, it just seems that that there's always a fresh angle to take. There's always something, you know, a new way of looking at a scene, and that for me makes it perfect for British comics.
Well, firstly, thank you very much.
All right.
You're very kind. Where that kind of approach comes from, I couldn't say. I guess, you know, we're all the sum total of all the things we've read and all the films we've watched, all the music we've listened to, aren't we? I wouldn't like to say that my approach is particularly original. There must be all sorts of influences in there somewhere that are finding their way out. But yeah, I'm quintessentially British. Yeah, I think that would be fair to say.
But you say, you know, it's not necessarily original, but I think what defines an awful lot of 2000 AD artists, yourself included, is that you take all those influences and make something new out of it. You know, yes, you're an amalgam of all those things in that are part of us all, but you know, nobody draws like Steve Yowell. Nobody draws like Jock or Fraser Irving or Dave Gibbons. You know, you look at your work, you look at other 2000 AD artists' work, and it's immediately recognisable in a way that an awful lot of artwork I don't think is.
Well, thank you again. I mean, I can remember just going back to my design education days. I mean, the way you went about designing anything was to look at what was already out there on the market and kind of take the things that you liked, but then add your own little twist and push it on further.
Yeah.
So I guess really we're all doing that subconsciously. You know, when it comes to comics artwork, when it comes to writing, I think that's what everyone's doing.
It's interesting because that echoes a quote from Steve McManus that I read, which is that Zenith was very much in the classic 2000 AD vein, characters with weird aspects. So, you know, the things that you expect but twisted ever so slightly to make them different and unusual. And certainly Zenith was that, wasn't it? It was the standard kind of superhero tropes, but through a twisted prism.
Yeah, it's a standard superhero tropes, but given a British slant.
Absolutely. Yeah. And with that phase one, and we'll come on to talk about what the Apex Edition reveals about phase one. One of the things I love about it is that it is this wonderful harking back to British war comics and in many ways the obsession with the Second World War that British comics had for the best part of 30 years. Because you have this Nazi super soldier and his British counterpart and you know, the impact that has on the present. And it's a wonderful kind of beginning of the story that you're... Grant and yourself are grounding it in a past that everybody in Britain recognises as fundamentally part of our national psyche.
Obviously, Grant's as grounded in DC Thompson war comics as
exactly. But then, you know, kind of saying, well, what impact does this have on the 1980s? What impact does this have on modern Britain? You know, ultimately, it's a destructive one.
You hit the nail on the head there, man.
Damn it. I just kind of wanted to get your feeling about that first phase and how it developed and how you as an artist changed and adapted over the course of those pages.
Well, what I liked about phase one structurally was the way it kind of gradually built on the tension episode after episode until, you know, we're introduced to Zenith in the early episodes, and then we're introduced to Maximan and the plot with the Loigor and the Brotherhood of the Black Sun. Mm. Oh, I've probably got that group name wrong. And then he kind of gradually racks up the tension over the subsequent episodes until we have the big fight scene at the end. It was a classic piece of structural, tight structural writing.
Mm.
In fact, the way I approached thumbnailing out those episodes was part of my ritual was to sit down with the script and play some cinematic background music, which is something I read Frank Bellamy used to do when he was illustrating. He'd put on mood music to get him into the right place for doing all that atmospheric double lit illustration. I seem to remember I was playing the soundtrack for A Nightmare on Elm Street quite a lot.
I can kind of see that.
You'd be surprised how it works.
Yeah,
those the episodes leading up to the storm building and Maximan having the fight with Ruby in London, and then finishing off poor old Chadwell. I kind of look back at those pages without thinking of that music.
Right. brilliant. And when you got to the end of phase one, this was your first major work.
Yeah.
You know, where you are co-creator, and you know, this is something that isn't just complete in of itself, it's going to continue. Did you kind of sit back and take stock?
I had a few weeks off. I guess you could call that sitting back and taking stock. Yeah. Well, actually, it wasn't long before we started gathering background material for the second series. I was out within a couple of weeks of finishing the first series. I was out buying background material on the Futurists to get the feeling for those futurist cityscapes that appeared in the prologue.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I presume your involvement in phase two was much heavier in terms of the background stuff than it had been for phase one, where Brendan had done a lot of the kind of visual stuff.
Yes, yeah, there was more design work that was my responsibility. Mm. I restyled Zenith's costume for that phase and subsequent phases. I think the idea always was that his costume was going to change all the time.
Mm.
And I based his studded jacket on something similar that George Michael was wearing in the Faith video at the time.
Right.
And the earring. I had much more responsibility, much more design responsibility for that series and on.
Let's talk about Zenith as a character for a moment. Did you ever get the feeling that he was a cipher for Grant, or was he an amalgam of all the influences, all the satire that is at the heart of Zenith?
I think he's an amalgam of all the satire and influences at the heart of Zenith and Grant.
Right.
He always brings something of himself into his work. Mm. I mean, in everything he's ever done.
Yeah.
You know, Zenith, Sebastiano, Invisibles, there's all bits of Grant in there.
Mm-hmm. And did when you were working on that first phase, was it easy to kind of pour maybe your own feelings about pop music and everything into that satire? Because he is a most venal, self-obsessed, shallow creature, which is a message that has echoed all the way down through the history of pop music is you know that these pop stars are just children. Was it easy to kind of pour your own feelings about pop culture into the way that you portrayed him?
I think so. It wasn't. I wouldn't say it was as considered as it might sound. But I mean, I guess all my feelings about pop culture found a way through the pen subconsciously somehow.
And that does lead me naturally onto the conclusion. What were your feelings about pop culture in the mid 80s?
I'm not sure I can remember it now. Mike. It was like so long ago. So pop culture back in the 80s and indeed the 70s, you know, in those halcyon days of Top of the Pops. Mm. I mean, a lot of us used to watch Top of the Pops just so we could pull school on it. You know, so it's like even the stuff, in a way, even the stuff you hated, you love really.
Yeah.
Because you loved hating it, if you see what I mean.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what were your musical influences at the time? What was the stuff you liked listening to?
Oh, I think I was listening to the Smiths at the time.
Right.
It was all the stuff that everyone was listening to in the 80s, I think. Mm. The Smiths and The Cure. But I've kind of always been, I'd like to think I've always been quite all embracing in my musical tastes. So I was listening to purely on the basis that I know Brendan was a big, or Brendan and Pete and Brett Ewins were big Roxy Music fans.
Yeah.
And I was playing a lot of early Roxy Music at the time. I was drawing Zenith, and then, you know, bits and pieces of classical and whatever. I mean, the kind of sort of heavy metal bands I used to listen to in my youth, you know, you always revisit those things, don't you? Just so you can have that, a bit of nostalgic toe curling.
Yeah. I 2000 AD for those first sort of 10 years or so really was a pop culture comic, because, you know, even harking back to the very first episode of Nemesis the Warlock, where even the cover is done up like a kind of album cover, and you've got Kenny Everett as a a termite DJ, but then you go all the way through to Zenith, and then, I mean, you just mentioned them there, Pete Milligan and Brett Ewins, with Deadline, which was essentially a music magazine with comics. Zenith kind of sits in that spectrum of, you know, 2000 AD being influenced by more than just comics.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there was it was increasingly apparent, just the number of people, the number of people from the music industry that read 2000 AD. I know. I'm pretty sure Lemmy was pictured with a copy of 2000.
Yes,
whether it's
just
for publicity purposes or not, I don't know. I know Robert Smith, I think, was a fan.
Mm.
There was a band with someone made up who looked very like the Joker in it that used to, I think they used to advertise in 2000 AD. For the life of me, I can't remember who they were. Oh, was it Alien Sex Fiend?
I don't know.
Yes, I'm sure they used to advertise in 2000 AD.
Okay.
Yeah, but of course, Pete and Brendan and Brett had actually worked for the what used to be called the Inkies, you know, the weekly music papers.
Oh yes, yeah, yeah.
In fact, Alan Moore used to write a comic strip for Sounds, didn't he? Yeah, The Stars My Degradation, and there was a strip previous to that, a kind of film noir gumshoe parody,
yes.
The name which escapes me. So there's always been this strange, and I do remember. Sounds having an article about Warrior when it first came out.
Right.
Because Axel Pressbutton in a kind of earlier version appeared in The Stars My Degradation.
Oh, really? Oh,
with the blessed Steve Moore, I imagine. He's like a, if you imagine his cyborg body was slightly different.
Yeah.
But it was probably a testing ground for Pressbutton.
Right, right. I'm going to... you know, I've got a copy of the Apex Edition in here with me. I'm going to take it out of its box because it is a wonder to behold, really. Tell us a little bit about how this came about.
Right. I think it was just in conversation with Ben and Keith.
Mm.
And is it Simon? Is the designer of the graphic novels? Just in conversation that the matter of what artwork still existed for Zenith.
Mm.
And I said I still had the whole of the first phase and big chunks of the second and third phases. Some of the pages of which have gone.
Mm.
I think they'd obviously been looking at the artist editions that IDW have been publishing. And I guess perhaps because I have the artwork, I mean, a lot of 2000 AD artwork has gone now.
Yes, Cast of the Four Winds.
Yes, sold and resold over the years.
Yeah.
And it's, again, right place, right time.
Mm.
I still have all the artwork for the first phase.
I mean, that's quite remarkable because, like, as you say, most 2000 AD artwork has been sold on multiple times, particularly of key moments in its history. Why did you keep hold of the whole of Phase One?
Who can say? I just couldn't bear to be parted with it.
Right. it's interesting here. One of the nice things about the Apex edition, which for our listeners is available through the 2000 AD store, but also from Diamond distributor retailer comic shops, it's at what I suppose you would call life size as it was done. But there's a note at the top of one of the pages that said that the second episode was actually the first that you drew. And you drew it 50% bigger than it was printed, but that was a little too big for you to handle comfortably.
Well, it's standard practice to draw the artwork 50% up on printed size. That's the universal approach through the comics industry in Britain and the US. Mm. I mean, you know, US comics back in the day used to be drawn twice up. And I think they changed to 50% up sometime in the mid to late 1960s.
Yeah.
So I just took the accepted route with that first episode, first episode I drew.
Yeah.
I got the wrong script just as a mix up in the office. I was none the wiser. It's only when I got to the end, I kind of realised there was a reference to something that had come before, that's how we discovered that I'd drawn the episode one before the prologue.
Right.
But I'd also read that Frank Bellamy used to draw only about 25% up on his Thunderbirds, the printed pages for Thunderbirds, because he preferred working that way because it meant that an editor looking at the original artwork would have a far better idea of how the printed artwork would look.
Right.
And that seemed just a much more comfortable size to be working.
Mm.
So I think it's about 30% bigger than printed size.
Yeah, that's what the note says.
Yeah. I talked it over with Richard. Again, back in those days, we weren't limited by the scanning machines the reprographics departments might have, because everything was, I can't remember the correct technical term, but everything's effectively photographed.
Yeah.
So you could draw whatever size you wanted. And I can remember seeing some painted covers. Again, the artist escapes me, but there's a later on, there's an oil painting of Mean Machine that someone did as a cover.
Mm-hmm.
I'd recognise it instantly if I saw it. I just can't remember who painted it.
Richard Dolan?
Might have been.
That was twice up.
That was 100% up on printed size, and which made it look huge. And then there was a mid phase when everyone started using digital reprographics techniques, where the artwork had to be a set size because it had to wrap around a drum to go in a laser separator.
Right.
So, which meant that we couldn't draw any bigger than A3.
Right.
But now, of course, now we're scanning our own material. I mean, in theory, we're back to being able to draw whatever size we want. It's subject to the how much work you want to make yourself scanning. And I know Chris Weston's gone. Chris draws twice up now. His roughs are 50% bigger than printed size, and his full size artwork is 100% bigger than printed size.
You see that way madness lies, I think. Well, I think one of the things that something like this, and it's the same with a lot of the artist editions, but it's nice to see it on something like Zenith, is just how nuts and bolts the process used to be. You know, now that everything's digital, it can in many ways lose a little bit of personality. But the fact, so on episode 5 of phase 1, we've got this lovely big picture of Peter St. John, and Peter St. John or Peter St. John?
I always said St. John.
Right. Okay. I've heard people say both.
I guess both are acceptable.
Yeah. on this, there's a little note at the top saying, first few episodes, I'd send a note with the art as to where I thought the logo might go on the page. Later, Richard Burton, who's the editor at the time, trusted me enough to send a batch of logos for me to paste up myself. Just the concept of an artist pasting up logos and stuff onto their artwork is just so wonderfully sort of, you know, old school and lo-fi. I feel kind of brings this artwork alive a lot more than
that's true of all the, as you said, it's true of all the artist editions, isn't it? It's just it's nice being able to see the blue pencil and the white out,
and the
notes in the margins. Yeah, what you don't get, of course, is the smell of the spray mount when you did that pasting up. You had to make sure you had plenty of ventilation.
Maybe we should do a little sachet of smell for any future ones.
A non-toxic one. Of
yeah. there's one note that I did want to ask you about, which was very early on, which the Nuke the Whippet slogan on Zenith's t-shirt. It says Grant has never adequately explained the slogan. Was this just something that was in the script and without any kind of extra explanation going on?
Yeah, literally that's right. All it was, if I remember rightly, in the panel description it asked for Zenith to be wearing a t-shirt which reads Nuke the Whippet, and in brackets it said don't ask. That's all I've ever known.
That sounds either like a special message or a bet, one way or the other. But this stuff has been sitting at the bottom of your wardrobe for all these years. What's it like seeing it in the flesh again? You know, just kind of, I don't know, brought back to life.
Yeah, it's like seeing an old friend. An old friend you have to treat very carefully because those word balloons are getting quite fragile. So yeah, it's always nice. I mean, to say that it was sitting in the bottom of my wardrobe is a little exaggeration. Okay. It's been sitting in a cupboard in my workroom.
Right. Okay.
So I wouldn't. I treated it rather more respectfully than that. But yes, it's like getting out. It's meeting an old friend again every time you sort through your cupboards.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's really striking about it is how accomplished your line work is, your brush work. For somebody who'd not really been working in comics that long, to go onto a series like this and have such a mastery of brushwork, is this just the result of lots and lots of practice, or is this just what came naturally to you?
The vain side of me would like to say it's what came naturally to me. The reality is that working in comics is a real sharp learning curve because of the volume of material you have to produce, and you do learn very, very quickly.
Yeah. And I think certainly in the context of the later phases, this also feels a lot more detailed. The backgrounds, especially, seem like you've put so much work into them. Were you sort of conscious of trying to impress, of making a good impression on not just the editorial staff, but also on the people who are going to be reading this?
Well, I wanted to bring the best to the project because it was such a good script. I think it just drove me on to those lengths. That sounds like the wrong word, doesn't it? It made sure I stayed nailed to the drawing board.
Right. Just looking through it now, one of the things I hadn't realised was that one of the rare colour pages in phase one was by Annie Parkhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realise that she coloured as well as having been one of our longest serving lettering droids.
Yes, I'm not sure how much of 2000 AD she'd coloured in the past, but certainly Richard told me that she was colouring those particular pages. The colourist later on in Phase 4 was Gina Hart,
yes,
who became a mainstay of 2000 AD.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, just on the point about lettering, I mean, you got Mark King's really just so accomplished lettering on this, but the sound effects especially are just, I mean, that flick to it now, where is it? It's the image where Zenith gets punched through, where is it? I'll find it in a second. Gets punched through Big Ben. And you've got that amazing thrack going across the top of the panel. How much as an artist do you feel the lettering on something like Zenith and seeing it in the Apex edition adds to the atmosphere and the storytelling of a script?
Well, the lettering generally always brings the comics pages to life. But it was Mark King was one of Gordon Robson's pen names.
Ah, I see.
But yeah, he did fabulous sound effects lettering, and it's a very integral part to the look of the strip.
And there's, we've got a little bit of stuff at the back, character designs and things like that. You've used the word nostalgia, but also you did the covers for the new hardback editions of phases 1 to 4.
Yeah.
What was it like revisiting this old friend?
It was a great experience. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Yeah. I'm sorry to use the old friends analogy again, but it's like, you know, it's just like chatting over old times with your mates.
Yeah, yeah.
Weren't comics great back then?
Yeah. I mean, you've already mentioned this, but there's that thing about wanting Zenith as a character to change over time, and I know that Grant and yourself have commented about how he has grown as you have got older. What's your feeling about how the character morphed and adapted and changed over the course of those 4 phases?
I think he found himself very much kind of not. He found himself to be not so much a bit player, but I think he kind of realised that his was going to have to be a team contribution to resolving the conflict with the Loigor, rather than or at least he realised it was going to have to be a team contribution when it suited him. I mean, he very quickly goes back to being the selfish, egocentric pop star at the end of every story. But I'd like to think he kind of grew a bit as a personality over the course of those 4 phases. You know, he's a little more mature at the end.
And what about you in terms of your style, but also your career? How what was the contrast between the Steve Yowell who went into Zenith, who got that word from Steve McManus saying there's a strip that we think you should be involved in, to the final episode?
The final episode of Zenith or the final episode of anything?
Final episode of Zenith.
Of Zenith. I'd like to think that I'd kind of settled down into being reliable and professional. Mm. I still have the same enthusiasm for every script I'm given. Mm. You know, it's that first rush of enthusiasm you get with a comic script. I mean, I haven't lost that from that very first episode of Zenith.
Yeah.
Maybe I haven't changed. apart from the fact, my eyesight's a lot worse. And like I say, got the bad back, the bad eyesight. I'm different in that way.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be remiss of me not to talk about the slight limbo that Zenith has been in over a number of years, and finally, you know, we're very pleased to be able to bring it to a public perhaps not as au fait with it as we are. What was it like as the artist to finally see it back in print?
It's great just to see it back in a format, a widely available format that hopefully everyone can read and enjoy.
Yeah. And I mean, is this something that I mean, you know, we're going to continue talking about your career beyond Zenith, but do you see Zenith as being career defining?
I think you're probably right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you never entirely escape the wrong word, but people are always very kind about that piece of work that remember, you know, they remember fondly, and that for me is Zenith.
Well, I'm not going to subject you to any more of my Bon Jovi impressions after such a great chat with Steve, everyone. Tune in next week when we're going to be doing the second part of our supplemental interview with Steve Yowell. Hope you've enjoyed it. Do stick around for more details about how you can read 2080 and also get hold of amazing graphic novels like Zenith. So for this week on the 2080 Thrillcast, I will bid you Splundig Verthrig Earthlitz. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2080 is in orbit every Wednesday from all good newsagents and comic book stores. 2080 is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2080online.com, or you can download the free 2080 app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2080 classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. In the meantime, all hail Tharg the Mighty and Splundig Verthrig, Earthlitz.